So sympathetic is trying to pull you out of dorsal, but dorsal rescues you from sympathetic, right? And it's this that I love that push-pull. That's what's happening all the time. Those two are trying to help you find the way to safety because the nervous system always, no matter what it's doing, and no matter how much suffering it's bringing us, its intention is to help us survive and find safety. Right? It just doesn't always know how to get us to that place of connection. But sympathetic is trying to get you out of collapse because collapse is so dangerous. And then dorsal is trying to get you out of the overwhelm of sympathetic because it's exhausting. But neither one can bring you to safety and connection.
Welcome to Our Power is Within. I'm your host, Chaz Smith, and my mission for this podcast is to inspire you to take your power back and to realize that you are the healer that you've been looking for all along. I believe that we are all capable of healing in mind, in body, and in soul. If you're new to this podcast, welcome. And if you've been tuned in for a while now and find value in this podcast, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple or my website at Our Power is Within. Other ways that you can support this podcast, you can leave a small donation by clicking the link, support this podcast in the show notes, or share your favorite episode on social media and tag me, or share this podcast with a friend. So this week, we are celebrating another podcast in our niche again. Yay! We are going to be hosting a fan favorite episode from the Post Viral podcast with co-hosts Lindsay and Stu. If you aren't yet familiar with Post Viral, they have a few seasons of awesomeness available for you to dig into. Season one was all about Lindsay and Stu's recovery and what helps them heal. And then season two is a set of interviews with some amazing experts in the areas that were covered in season one. Another cool fun fact. Lindsay's actually been on this podcast, episode number 125, where she shares her personal story. She also has a very cool collaboration project with Liz Carlson, who's also been on this podcast. Together, they have created a CFS program guide, which now has over 27 different CFS recovery programs extensively reviewed to help you narrow down the right program for you. She also offers coaching to help support other people on their healing journeys. All right. So today's episode was one of the Post Viral's fan favorites with Deb Dana, and it makes sense why this was a fan favorite. Deb is a renowned author and expert in polyvagal theory. Her work alongside of Dr. Stephen Borges has been pivotal to changing the way trauma work is approached today. And I think you're going to love this episode. If you don't already follow Post Viral Podcast, head over to Apple or Spotify and give them a follow. Please enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome, Deb Dana.
Oh, it's good to be here. It's lovely to meet you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited. As I told you before, I've read your book, The Polyvagal Theory in Therapy. And most of my questions today are going to be centered around that book. So if people are interested, they can check it out. But hopefully we'll help people understand polyvagal theory and ways it can be used in their day-to-day life, which is such amazing work that you do.
Oh, thank you. I would love to have that happen because my goal is always to help people understand their nervous system and be able to actively operate it in ways that serve their well-being. So this is great.
Wonderful. Yeah, fundamental to our illness, which is a nervous system disorder. So just to start, how was it that you first came upon Dr. Porgy's work with polyvagal theory and how did that go at the start?
Yeah, so I read Steve's book, his first book, and I'd always been a neuroscience nerd. I'm a clinical social worker, and I've always thought the brain was fundamental to understanding what we're doing and that our clients should understand the basics of their brain. And then I read Steve's book. And it was like, oh my goodness, there's this missing piece of the puzzle that just came into clarity for me that before the brain makes up the story, we have an embodied response. We have a nervous system that first activates. And I was hooked from then on, and I started playing around with his brilliant theory, but how do I make it applicable to my work with clients? Mm-hmm. Right. And so for the first couple of years, I think I drove my colleagues crazy because I would come in with, let's try this out and try this worksheet and try this way and try that way. And my colleagues would give me wonderful feedback. So they really helped me shape it in a way that everyday people can understand. Steve is brilliant, also very humble human, very kind human, and he was delighted that his work would find a way into therapy offices and everyday living. And so he was wonderful. I reached out to him and asked him if he would come to Maine, where I live most of the time, and give a workshop for my colleagues. And he said, I'd love to come. So he came and we met, and he looked at what I was doing, and I got to ask him all the questions that you can't get answered out of a book, right? Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the beginning of this partnership that's been going on now for, I don't know, a decade or more of but really being an active partner with me and bringing this work to life in this way. So great gratitude to him, both for his brilliance in developing the theory and then his accessibility and support of bringing it into the clinical world.
Yeah, what a blessing that you two came together, because he's truly a genius in what he came up with. But with a lot of these scientists, and I've worked with scientists directly, sometimes they have trouble translating it to the general public and into practical tools. And that's where you came in. And I'm so, so glad that you did that. So many people have benefited. So for people who don't know what we're talking about out there, how would you define polyvagal theory in the most simple definition? I know it's a complex thing.
It is, but I think if we think it's a theory about the autonomic nervous system, and the autonomic nervous system is at the heart of our daily living. It's our embodied system that helps us navigate through the world. And the autonomic nervous system is divided into parts. And what Steve did with polyvagal theory was really bring those to life in a way that we could then track where we are, where we might be heading, what takes us to certain places. So polyvagal theory, I think of as three organizing principles: neuroception, hierarchy, co-regulation. And I know they're odd words, but neuroception is the word Steve created to define how the nervous system, this embodied system, not a brain system, but a body system, takes in information. So it's not perception, because that's a cognitive brain experience. It's a body experience. So neuroception is the word he created. And neuroception is working all the time, listening to what's going on both inside our bodies, outside in the environment around us, and in the space between people, right? And its primary job is to listen and decide, does it feel safe enough to keep going, safe enough to engage, or is there danger and we should use one of our survival responses, either fight or flight or collapse? And that's really the job of the nervous system, is to make that initial determination. Yes, no, move forward, move backward, approach, avoid. Right? Safe, unsafe. So that's neuroception, the organizing principle. Then we have hierarchy, because when neuroception takes in the information and says, yes, safe enough, we go to the top of the hierarchy, which is called the ventral vagal system. That's a system of safety and connection. That's where you and I are right now. We're able to connect, to communicate, to see each other, to smile, right? To be with. That's a ventral vagal experience. Again, we can name that for ourselves. You might name that, you know, your place of safety and connection or regulation. So that's the first place. But if neuroception feels, oh, it doesn't feel quite so safe here, its first stop is down one step on the hierarchy into the sympathetic nervous system, which most of us know as fight and flight. And most of us understand, oh yeah, I know fight and flight really well. Right? That twin pathway of anger and anxiety, mm-hmm. right? That's a survival response. When neuroception says not safe, we go first to this fight and flight. If it feels incredibly unsafe, or if going to fight and flight doesn't get us out of the danger, we then go to the other survival response, which is called dorsal. It's the bottom of the hierarchy, and it's a place of collapse, shut down, disconnect, kind of float away. And you can feel it in my voice even when I talk about it. You know, the energy from sympathetic, that fight-flight energy drains from the system. So that's hierarchy. And the beautiful thing about hierarchy is that it goes in a predictable order. We're in ventral. The first stop is sympathetic survival, fight, flight. The next stop is dorsal survival, shut down, collapse, disappear. What's so helpful about that is when we're experiencing something and we can track where we are. If I know I am overwhelmed and I'm in sympathetic, I also know that if I don't resolve what's happening, I'm probably going to land in the bottom of the hierarchy and collapse and shut down. So we've done neuroception, we did hierarchy. The third and the you know, really lovely one about being human is co-regulation. Co-regulation is this capacity to regulate with another being, to feel safe enough with someone else that we can do this back and forth. Reciprocity of regulation, right? And when we have enough of those experiences of co-regulation, then we learn how to self-regulate, right? That's the growing up experience, or the way it's supposed to be, the order it's supposed to come. We have safe others who help us co-regulate, and then we move out into the world and self-regulate, right? And I would like to say for many, many people, that wasn't true, right? We self-regulated because there wasn't someone around who we could depend on to help us come to a place of co-regulation. And the right. Lovely news about the nervous system is you can learn to co-regulate at any time in your life, right? Just because you didn't learn it early doesn't mean, oh, I've missed it. It means, no, you know, it's waiting. And when there are safe others around, co-regulation can then be experienced, and we can bring that to life again. So sort of a long way around talking about the basics, but I think those three organizing principles really help us understand, oh, that's what my nervous system is doing all the time.
Yeah.
It is looking for cues of welcome or warning, and then it's moving me in and out of regulation. And being around other people who feel safe is a resource. That's sort of the basics.
Yeah, definitely. And we're going to go into those specific areas. So let's start with neuroception, since you started there. Is this something that we're cognitively aware of, or is it a subconscious thing? It's something that's happening on a different level. It's so hard when we can't like scientifically prove some of these things. Is this a theory, or is there proof of this? Like, how do you conceptualize neuroception?
Well, I mean, in its sort of curious human being terms, I often call it our autonomic intuition, right? We have this gut feeling, this gut sense, and that's your nervous system taking in these cues. Can we prove it? What's the science behind it? You know, what I will say is that polyvagal theory is a theory, right? And theories are meant to be proven, disproven, hypotheses are challenged. And the lovely thing about polyvagal theory is that thousands of peer-reviewed articles now are supporting Steve's basic premises. Whether I could go into a lab and show you neuroception at work, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do we perceive it? No, it's happening below the level of our awareness. And so we don't interact directly with neuroception. We interact with neuroception as it moves us somewhere. So we feel the change. We feel the physiology change. We feel a story change. Our emotions change. Our behaviors change. That's the outcome of neuroception. And that's really what we're working with. So we invite our brain to come into the picture, and we bring perception to the experience of neuroception.
Yeah, I can think of a few distinct times in my life where I was aware of it. I lived with a family kind of as a nanny. I remember walking in the room and I could just feel the mother's sadness without even seeing her face. I could just feel she was just so unhappy. And there is a gut feeling that you can get sometimes before you're even aware. And that's like one example where where I feel like I've had it, but I'm sure it's happening all the time. And we're just,
it is happening all the time. And we're not trained to listen to it. Right. And what happens is neuroception, all of that information then moves to our brain, and our brain makes up a story. So we hear the story. What often happens is we don't listen to our neuroception. Right. That I know if I reflect back, I can think of so many times when if I had listened, I would have done something different. And I had a clue or an inkling that I should say no, but I ignored it. And I went ahead and said yes anyway. And then it's like, oh, shouldn't have done that. Right. Yeah. Probably everybody listening can think of that moment. Right. When they said, oh, on reflection, I really should have paid attention to whatever that was, but we're not taught how to listen to that. And then when we think, ooh, my brain's telling me all these reasons why I should, but I've got this sensation that says, no, I'm going with my brain, because that's what we're taught, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And definitely when I was sick, I heard that a lot, that like, trust your gut. And it would be frustrating sometimes because you're like, I'm sick. I just want someone to help me. And I'm sure people out there really relate to that. I've said, trust your gut, surely. But now when I look back on my illness, there's certain elements like my neck issues. I always felt like that was a part of my chronic health problems, but no doctor was validating that until in the last few years, I found a doctor who was like, absolutely, that's part of your chronic fatigue. And it's like trusting yourself that if you feel like that's right, that there's probably something to it.
And I love what you just said, because, you know, the medical world did not have a reason to believe you, so to speak. And yet you knew, right? Mm-hmm. You knew on a biological level that, yes, this is all connected. And, you know, fighting for what you know through your neuroception, through your embodied pathways is so hard to do when everybody is saying there's no evidence, or, you know, giving you other labels. Because that's their brains trying to make sense of something they can't make sense of. So I love that you finally found someone who said, of course. I find I say that to my clients all the time. Of course, that's what's happening, because your nervous system is feeling in danger. Of course, makes perfect sense.
And finding that validation, it eventually does really make a difference too. But for an extent, you really do have to advocate for yourself, unfortunately, in this world.
and I'm not sure that neuroception is understood in the medical world.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll have a feeling and I'll think about, should I reach out or call this person, do whatever? And my brain still, you know, after all these years of this is my life's work, my brain still often overrides it and said, no, not yet or not now. So yeah, we really need to tune in and then honor what we're hearing. I think it's the tuning in step one, but then honoring it. And what do we do with that information?
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I mean, I feel like we could do a whole show on just neuroception. But getting into the first area we talk about is the dorsal vagal system. And I know in your book, you talk about it as the oldest system. Can you talk about why that evolutionarily would be the oldest system and what that means? I like animal analogies, so feel free.
I love it. Yeah. So in our history, not mammal history, but the phylogenetic line of our history, it began with these boneless fish. Steve has some wonderful images that trace where the branches of our history diverge. But we, you know, these boneless fish, right? That had a dorsal vagal system, and that system, in order to survive, they would go into death feigning mode. They would immobilize. Right, if we bring it up to current times, you can see it in a mouse that a cat has caught, a mouse, and the mouse is in the jaws of the cat, but it looks dead. That's its dorsal system.
I've seen them freeze.
And then when the cat lets go of it, because the cat wants something alive, not dead, right, the mouse then shakes it off and runs away. Right. So, but that death feigning was the first sort of survival response in our human history. And in its regulated role now for us, it runs our digestion. So it's responsible for bringing nutrients to nourish us. And then in this survival role, it still brings us that either that immobilization or that collapse, that shutdown, no energy to run our system, right? And you think about your illness and the ways that the dorsal response.
I was just going to say that some people have said that it's like what chronic fatigue is your body going into shutdown and being like, okay, I've hit a breaking point and now I'm done. And it really does feel like, for me at least, that's what happened.
Yeah. And there's just no energy. You know, some people can talk to you and say, come on, get out of bed, or come on, do this. But it's like your biology saying, no energy, right?
Yeah.
And that's a protective survival response that's left over from like 500 million years ago, because evolution doesn't throw things out, it just builds on top, right? So that was the first system. And actually, as we develop in utero, it's the first system to develop, right? So in the beginning weeks of you know, development in utero, a fetus begins to develop this dorsal system.
Yeah. And the other thing you said too about the digestion is interesting, because a lot of people with chronic fatigue have extreme constipation at time, or gut issues in general. I had huge gut issues with candida and SIBO and just all these systems going off. And it sounds like it's probably because of that stuckness the dorsal vagal reaction.
When we lose the oversight of our ventral system, then dorsal can only do as a survival role. It can't do its regulated digestive role. So digestion's out of whack in a variety of different ways. So when we get stuck in survival, we lose all of these health benefits and we have all these risks that come to life. Yeah.
Okay, and now looking at sympathetic, it's interesting with chronic fatigue. And actually reading your book, I wasn't sure if I understood it or not, because we have this thing with chronic fatigue where we call it tired and or wired, where you have so much energy. It's actually not real energy. It's fake energy. And then you crash. It's called the push crash cycle also. And I wasn't sure if that was the same as sympathetic nervous system activation, because you also talk about after something stressful, you want to go for a run. So like in a good way, but for us, it's, you got to be careful with that energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because what you're saying is exactly right. The sympathetic nervous system, what came into our history, our phylogenetic history about 400 million years ago. So dorsal 500, sympathetic 400 million. And it is that in survival mode, it's that overwhelming chaotic flood of energy that's fight and flight and activates cortisol and adrenaline, right? And we probably all know what that feels like, that surge, right? And one of the other things that sympathetic does is it tries to pull you out of dorsal, right? And that, I think, is what you're talking about. You have this tired or wired. You go from tired to a bit of wired, but the wired is overwhelming too much. You go back to tired. Mm-hmm. And that's the dorsal, sympathetic, dorsal loop that we get into. Trauma survivors get into that loop as well, because the wired piece, the sympathetic energy, is too big, too much, too overwhelming. And instead of helping us find the way to ventral, where the energy is organized and useful, it overwhelms our system and we go back to dorsal shutdown. So sympathetic is trying to pull you out of dorsal, but dorsal rescues you from sympathetic, right? And it's that I love that push-pull. That's what's happening all the time. Yeah. Those two are trying to help you find the way to safety, because the nervous system always, no matter what it's doing and no matter how much suffering it's bringing us, its intention is to help us survive and find safety.
Right.
It just doesn't always know how to get us to that place of connection. But sympathetic is trying to get you out of collapse, because collapse is so dangerous.
Right.
And then dorsal is trying to get you out of the overwhelm of sympathetic, because it's exhausting. But neither one can bring you to safety and connection.
Right. So is it like a little bit of either is okay, but with CFS, it's like we're going to the extreme with both of them?
Yes. And what happens is, if we're trying to come out of dorsal, we have to bring some energy back, So mm-hmm. yes, we need to travel through sympathetic mm-hmm. on the way up to ventral. I like to think of it as two pathways coming out of dorsal. There's a pathway that goes to the edges of sympathetic and brings some of the energy, mm-hmm. some of the mobilizing energy that helps us then keep going up. The pathway that you're talking about, the pathway that many of us take and many trauma survivors take, is the pathway out of dorsal that goes directly back into survival energy. And then we can't move through it. We keep going back to dorsal and being in that loop again, because we do have to bring some energy back in, right? Sympathetic has this overwhelming energy. The energy's there, but it's not in a form we can use it. It's chaotic, disorganized flooding, right? If we can organize it in some way, titrate it in some way, then the energy helps us come back up to ventral. Right.
I think that's really good understanding. People out there will probably relate, where you like literally feel like you can't stop scrolling on your phone because your brain is so overactive. You're like, how is it I have so much energy? Do question that when you were just crashed the day before. Right. It is such a loop. I don't feel like I was in a healing mode until I was able to find a balance where I was pacing slowly and not going to those extremes.
Right. And the thing that keeps us from the extremes is having enough ventral active and circulating in our system, right? Mm. You don't have to be fully immersed in ventral, but you have to have a toehold or have one foot in ventral while the rest of you is working with sympathetic and dorsal. It's the ventral energy that helps manage the amount of sympathetic and dorsal that's in your system. As long as you have enough ventral, I like to call it a critical mass of ventral, whatever that is for me in this moment, I have enough so that sympathetic and dorsal can move with me, can help me rather than taking me to survival.
Mm. Yeah, so let's talk about the ventral vagus state a little bit more now, and how maybe people with chronic fatigue, how they can find ventral vagal, more of that in their life. Yeah. And I know one thing you're going to say is probably co-regulation. I know people out there are going to be like, I'm so sensitive to light. I'm so sensitive to noise. I have all these issues. It's so hard. So just where do you think people could start with ventral?
Ventral is the essential ingredient we have to have, but we can take it in micro moments, right? And really the nervous system reshapes by doing small things over and over. And I think that's helpful for everybody to remember. You don't have to, you know, bring in a whole bunch of ventral and be there with somebody else and, you know, trying to manage all the sensitivities. You just need micro moments. Right. And I call those glimmers, right? So we're looking for the glimmers, which are the micro moments of ventral that happen frequently, regularly during the course of a day, but we miss them. Mm-hmm. Right. So we're just looking for this tiny moment of ease, or, oh, I felt some warmth, or touch on my skin that felt okay. Mm-hmm. Or my pet was just there. Right. I love pets because they really don't ask anything. They just give. Yeah. Right. And so many, many people, you know, in your world, probably, and in my world, working with trauma survivors, a pet is the best thing to have, because that's a co-regulating experience. Right. 100%. And when it comes to humans, we're co-regulation. We need to be able to tell them, this is the way I can, you know, be with you right now. This is how I can take in your offer to co-regulate. Right. And when we're sick, it's in very small amounts. And sometimes it's just be in the same room over there. So I can feel your regulated energy. I know you're here. I can feel your presence, but there's no demand to do anything, because a demand, even the tiniest demand to just say hi or look or whatever, that tiny demand can quickly overwhelm the nervous system. And then we go back to survival.
Right. That's a really good point. Yeah, because I know I use the same examples a lot. So I'm sorry to listeners, but what I did during my illness, I moved to one of the Gulf Islands off the coast of Vancouver, because I was like, I'm going to heal in nature. Secretly, let's be honest, I didn't want to be a burden. I wanted to get away from all my friends doing fun things. And I slowly got worse and worse and worse while I was there because I was so isolated and I was so alone. And my friends ended up having an intervention and got me back to Vancouver because I was literally bedbound, living alone. Yeah. And even though I was still living alone in Vancouver, I felt the support. They were dropping off food. They were always asking me if I needed anything. Just knowing that support is around you is a key piece to healing.
Yeah. And finding the support network that can show up the way your nervous system needs is right. key. I think the best thing we can do for that is have some self-compassion around that, to understand this has nothing to do with your will to recover, whether it's from illness or from trauma. It has nothing to do with your will. It's all about your biology feeling either safe enough or not safe enough.
100%. Yeah. People always ask, where were your parents? And it's not that they wouldn't have helped me if I asked, but I just wanted someone to come in and help me. You know, I didn't even have the power to ask. I was just like stuck in my state.
Yeah. Exactly. And it makes perfect sense. Of course, you don't have the capacity to say, I need help. You just need people to show up.
Yeah. Exactly. No, that's a really great explanation. So one thing I learned from your book that I didn't know before was just how often we're switching between states too. I guess I kind of before thought of these as like big moments in life in particularly, but it's actually quite often, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we move down and up that hierarchy all the time in small ways, right? So already today it's early afternoon for me and I'm thinking back to my day so far and I've been all over the place. I've dipped into some anxiety of sympathetic. Mm-hmm. I've had some flavor of dorsal hopelessness. I've had a lot of ventral showing up connecting, and that is normal. That's normal and expected that we move, you know, between states in small ways and sometimes in big ways, mm-hmm. right? All the time. We also move within states. Right. So they're different flavors. If you think about fight and flight, right, it can begin with, ooh, a little worry, a little angst, a little perseveration, a little, oh, I don't know. And then it can move to, you know, anxiety and at its, you know, at its far reach, it's panic. Mm. Right. But there are all these flavors depending on how intensely my sympathetic system is activated. And then dorsal is the same. You know, for me, my first flavor of dorsal is I'm sort of not quite as present as I was a moment ago. And then it moves to going through the motions. So I can look like I'm doing okay, but I'm not really here. And I have no energy to care about it. Right. And then at its extreme again, it's like curled up in bed, can't move.
When reading your book, that came up to me a lot. I think I was going into dorsal a lot more than I realized, because any kind of confrontation makes me freeze and then I'd cry afterwards. You know, I've never been good at confrontation. And I think that's an interesting thing that I ended up getting CFS, because that's a very high tendency for my body already to shut down. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, because people often think ventral is calm, I want to help people remember there are lots of flavors of ventral too. Calm is one of them, but it's also passionate and purposeful and strong and joyful and playful. And, you know, all of these flavors, the way you know that you are in a state of ventral is that if we go back to neuroception, your neuroception is one of safe enough. Right? That's how you know. So if I'm feeling safe enough, I used to say neuroception of safety. And then I thought it's really hard to feel safe, safe, full stop nowadays, but safe enough, right? Where the cues of safety outweigh the cues of danger. That's safe enough. And when you're safe enough, then you're in ventral and there are all those lovely flavors of ventral that come to life too.
That's a really good point, because some people are living in situations they don't feel like they have the power to change something about it that they know is probably stressing them out, is probably affecting their nervous system. But that doesn't mean you're a lost cause if you can't change that aspect, right? There's still things you can do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think that's true for lots of us, that there's something in a relationship, an environment, you know, in our own internal embodied system that we can't change yet, right? Or at the moment.
Yeah.
Maybe it's unchangeable forever. I don't know. But most things, you know, feel that way. But okay, I can't change it at this moment. And what I want to do is I want to say, what are all the cues of danger that are alive and active in this experience I'm in? Those are usually easy to find. We gravitate towards those. But then I want to look for, what are the cues of safety that are present, but I may be missing? And then when I've identified what these all are, then I can begin to work to shift, right? Because there may be a cue of safety that carries a lot of weight in your system and can outweigh several cues of danger. It's not a one-to-one correspondence here. And if I can find the cues of safety that I reliably can feel come to life in my system, I can then usually manage to be in some of those cues of danger without getting hijacked into a survival state. For me, it's often an environmental cue of safety that can outweigh a lot of cues of danger. Right? I have certain images, certain photographs, I have beach stones that mean a lot to me. So something that is tangible and in my environment can often help my system stay in a bit more regulation. What about you? Is there a cue of safety you'd draw on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I talk a lot about fostering a passion. And for me, when I was sick, oh my gosh, I would just, first I started when I was bedbound, just listing dog breeds in my brain. And like, because I love dogs. And I would just go to the things I love, like dog breeds. And when I had a bit more capacity, I started doing painting. And when I could walk, I was like making my goal structured around getting to the next house that has a dog or the next dog park. Things that I'm passionate about, I was always keeping in mind to like help push me forward in my recovery. And I interviewed someone, Michael Towers, who wrote comic book, the CFS superhero. He couldn't even lift his arms. And he would just start with these little scribbles of a comic book. And he was literally on feeding tubes. And just the way fostering a passion of any kind can help you get out of that state. I love that you brought that background to why that is so helpful.
And I love where you started saying you were, you know, thinking about dog breeds.
Yeah. Right?
And we want to remember that imagining before enacting is the way to go. Because as you imagine, you're bringing it alive and your nervous system begins to feel that come to life and your motor cortex brings it alive. So it's as if you were having a taste of doing it.
Yeah.
And for many of us, imagining is the first small step into whatever it is, because again, your nervous system feels safe enough to let you imagine. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why these brain retraining programs, we've talked about the pros and cons of positive psychology, but a big piece of them is visualization and visualizing yourself well and what you want to be doing when you're well. And I think when I did that, that was a big piece of my healing as well, is like working on those visualizations.
For many people, moving, being seen moving, feels dangerous. Right? Mm. Like dancing or playing in public or whatever feels dangerous. And so I started, and for me, it's often that way. Like I do amazing things in my head, but as soon as somebody invites me to do it out here in the world, I go to dorsal disappearing. Right. And for me, the imagination is amazing and wonderful and beautiful. Imagining moving. Right. And so, you know, I would encourage people to experiment with imagine moving. Right? Because you'll begin to feel some of the energy of that in a titrated way that's safe enough for your nervous system.
Getting more into practical tools, practical uses of polyvagal theory and how people can take all this information and use it in their life. Can you speak about the four R's you talk about in your book? Recognize, respect, regulate, restore. Can you talk about what those mean and how you can use those in your life?
Sure. So recognize is where we always start. You know, it's this notice and name practice, like notice what state is taken over my system right now and name it. You know, whether that's ventral, sympathetic, and dorsal, or you give it fight, flight, collapsed, whatever you want to call it. But that recognize is where we have to start, because otherwise we simply enter into a pattern And we believe this is the only pattern there is, right? So recognize. And then the next is respect. That's turning toward and honoring that your nervous system has taken you there for a reason, right? And I don't need to know the reason right now. I just simply need to honor that, okay, my nervous system is intuiting a neuroception of danger and it's taken me to this shutdown place. Or my nervous system has taken me to ventral. I'm going to respect that, even though it feels unfamiliar and not entirely safe in this moment. That is true too. When we begin to find ventral again, it can feel very unfamiliar, right? And we don't trust it. Right. So recognize, respect, then we regulate or co-regulate, right? Back into a place where we have enough ventral active and circulating in our system so that we can begin to bring perspective. We can reflect. We can begin to do the things that, you know, help us stay anchored in that place of safety, connection, regulation, right? And from there we restore. It is only when we come back to this place of enough regulation that then the story organically changes. Your story in dorsal is one of hopelessness, right? Some flavor of hopelessness. I'll never recover. I'm too broken. Yeah. I'm too toxic, right? These are the stories. In sympathetic, the stories are one of either criticism inside, you know, it's about me being bad, unworthy, you should, you need all these, you know, you have to. These are all sympathetic driven. The sympathetic energy is driven. So the stories are driven. We're seeking, but we can never be satisfied. When we come to ventral, the stories organically change into stories of hope, stories of connection, community, possibility, right? So you can't restory until you find a bit of regulation or co-regulation. If you try to restory when you are still stuck in survival, you're fighting against your biology, and your biology is not going to let you come up with a story of hope. Recognize, respect, regulate, restory process that has to go in that order. And in fact, once we regulate or co-regulate, the story will naturally change. And it's our job to sort of notice, ooh, how is my story changing? Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that restory piece too, thinking about how I would freeze in confrontation. I think my mind goes straight to like, they hate me, there's something wrong with me, unworthiness or wrongness in the world. Exactly. And yeah, the restory piece, I think, is huge of getting out of that state.
Yeah.
In terms of how we regulate, I guess, do you have some exercises that you recommend when people get to that stage? And
two things come to mind that actually two or three, but let's start. I mean, you know, the first, I think, is let's talk about anchors, ventrovagal anchors, right? And anchors come in the category of who, what, where, and when, right? And they are in these categories, there are things that at one time in our life we have experienced. So they're stored in our biology, right? Not necessarily stored in our brain in this way, but our biology, our nervous system has taken them in, right? So if we were going to think about that, the first thing is a who. You know, who is a person who, when you're around them or you remember being around them, brings you a glimmer of that ventral energy of safety and connection, right? And it may be a pet as well. Right. But it's somebody that you've actually had that person to person connection with. Right. Because then you can bring that person to mind and your nervous system brings it to life again. That's a who, a what. What is something you do, a tiny something you do that brings you a reminder that, oh, ventral lives, ventral exists. And for me, and maybe for you, it was simply looking out the window to see there's a world out there. That was it. Right.
Yeah. Getting some sun. Yeah.
Yep. I'm lucky to live that where I look out my world and my window and there's nature.
Yeah.
And nature has been shown to bring some ventral energy alive. So just finding a way to connect with nature. But people would tell me, you know, they would do something like they would organize their kitchen counter, right? They would move things around so that it looked neat. That was it. It's just some little thing that brings you a reminder, oh, ventral is here for me. Right.
And that's nice. Yeah. I like that because it's like finding what works for you and doing it in a cognizant way. Okay, I'm going to do this now, because sometimes we maybe do these things and we don't even realize it.
Exactly.
And we're still in our thought process of our negative loop.
Yeah. So if you, you know, even holding a cup of hot tea, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, we often do, but if we hold it and go, oh, ventral, just for a moment, oh, ventral anchor, it changes our experience of it. And it begins to accumulate in our system and reshape our system, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the who, what, the where is a place in the world where when you're there, you feel, you know, oh, I want to stay here a while, right? And the lovely thing about aware is I don't have to be able to get there now. I can just remember, bring it to life through remembering, right? So the beach is aware for me, and I'm not anywhere near a beach where I'm living right now, but I remember the beach and it comes alive, right? So if you are bed bound, you still can remember aware and it will come alive, right? And then the last is when, like when are the predictable moments? It could be time of day. I'm an early morning person, so early morning is a time that's a when for me. Right. It could be a phone call you get from a friend at a certain time. It's just, it's a predictable moment when you think, oh, there's ventral, right? We're just looking for how is ventral appearing in my life? And then we, you know, I invite people to keep a list, right? Because you'll keep adding to your list. You'll keep finding anchors. And sometimes anchors will go away. You cross it off the list. That doesn't work anymore. That's okay.
Right.
Right. When the pandemic hit, that happened for most of my clients. Their anchors were like, yeah, that doesn't work anymore. Right?
Right.
So we created new ones. That's okay. So ventral anchors are one that I encourage everybody to do. And then, you know, the other is simply sighing, right? It's interesting. Breathing is such both a regulator or can be, but it's also an activator, right? Because for many people who have breath problems, and with COVID, breathing was impacted. And once you sort of worry about your ability to breathe, that's an anxiety provoking
experience
ongoing.
Definitely. Right?
And so, you know, and for trauma survivors, which is where, you know, where my work was, trauma survivors have a breath pattern that protects them from connecting with their unresolved trauma experiences. Most trauma survivors breathe up in the high chest. Right. You know, if you're having trouble breathing, you're going to breathe high chest because you can't get a deep breath. Right? So what I encourage people to do is just notice when you sigh, because we sigh spontaneously, all of us, many times an hour. And sighing resets your nervous system and resets your cognitive system in a just a micro moment of reset. So just noticing there's a sigh says, oh, my nervous system is resetting. You know, that's a nice thing, right? It's bringing a bit of regulation, but we can also intentionally sigh. And sighing is somehow different from breathing when it comes to your brain systems. The brain doesn't get as worried about sighing as it does about changing breath patterns, right? So we can sigh when we're in dorsal, we can sigh with despair. Did you ever sigh with despair?
I'm sure I did. Yes.
Right. And just to think, oh, when I sigh with despair, there's a momentary reset and a momentary relief from that dorsal despair. In sympathetic, we know we sigh in frustration. Oh, right? Oh, so you know, it's a momentary reset. And then ventral, when you have a moment of ventral, you can sigh with relief that you it's still there, or you can sigh with contentment that, oh, yes, right? So just sighing with intention is an easy way to reach for a bit of regulation. And in my work, and I think in, you know, in helping people recover from, you know, long COVID and CFS, it's the small things we can reach for that feel attainable.
Yes.
As soon as we make it too big, we're going to fail, and then we feel that failure build on itself.
Absolutely.
So I want it to be something that's so small that I can reach for it and be successful, because then my biology is encouraged to reach again. My brain does its own thing and you know, makes up a great story, but my biology wants a little bit more of that, right? And that's what I'm looking for.
So there's a lot of people out there who talk about like vagus toning exercises, vagus nerve exercises. And there was a lot of that starting and failing especially with the cold water therapies. Oh, I tried so many times to do cold showers. I did in like the last year, make it a part of my morning routine to hum my mantras. Mm-hmm. And after, I mean, honestly, maybe 4 or 5 months of it, I did notice the humming relaxing my system in a noticeable way. And when I started to feel like that overwhelmed feeling, I'd hum and I noticed that it was working, but that took a lot of patience and people just want something quick and easy. And I have to tell them this can help you, but it takes a lot of practice. So I really love you saying that.
And it's not a one size fits all, because at the beginning of the pandemic, people were saying, do these 5 things or do these 3 things. And, you know, it was like my nervous system kept saying no to all of them. And I thought, and I began to think there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, people are telling me what works for their nervous system, not necessarily what works for mine. And so we need to play around with a menu of choices and figure out, does this work for me? Right. I love this works for Lindsay, but does it work for me?
Yeah.
And to stick with it, be persistent and give it time. Because again, the shifts happen slowly over time. So I like that you said that too.
Yeah. No, that's honestly, when I bought your book, I thought it was going to be more of those things. I thought it was going to be all vagus nerve exercises like that. And it ended up being so much more about learning how it works and process of noticing and reorienting. But do you have some favorite exercises that you do other than the sighing, of course?
You may laugh, but I have just got in my bedroom, my, you know, for most people knowing my husband's has health issues and is very compromised. And so we have home care part of the time. So I have my own bedroom space and I wanted to make it a place that felt welcoming, that felt ventral, energized. And I found a chair, you'll laugh, but you know, it swivels and it reclines, but it glides.
Oh,
and
neat.
That gliding motion, which, you know, you can do as you're sitting there, just this back and forth gliding motion for my nervous system is incredibly regulating and quick.
Oh, right? Wow. Yeah.
So I discovered that. I mean, a lot of people have rocking chairs because rocking.
Right.
Mine loves the glide. Who knew? And I was at a store that sells everything, and I was with my grandkids, and I just sat down to take a break, and I sat in this thing, and I went, oh my God, I discovered this. I said, I have to take this home, because it was that motion, right? So if people can find, and it's very gentle, gentle. If people can find a gentle motion, that's often a way that the nervous system can begin to reorganize and find its way to regulation and stay there. So, you know, that's probably my favorite.
I love that. I love the simple things that people can use or do. And, mm-hmm. and like you say, finding something that works for you, that feels regulating, and stick to that in your way. In April last year, so 1 year ago, I got my dog. That's when I felt like I was well enough that I could probably take care of a dog. It was still a risk. You know, you never know with your health if you're going to keep getting better. I've had a lot of ups and downs, but my health has skyrocketed since then. But previous to that time, I wouldn't have been able to care for a dog. I was not well enough. And it is interesting just thinking of where you are at in your recovery journey and what you can take on as your ventral vagal regulator.
You can even build this is what I can do now. Yeah. I use circles a lot. And inside the circle, here are the things that you know, the very inside circle that I can do now, moving out a little bit. Here are the things that are a bit of a stretch, but I can do in limited ways. And then the bigger circle, here are the things that you know, I'm sort of going to reach for as I continue to recover, so that we're always offering that sort of hope to our system, right? Mm. I'm not just stuck here, but I also don't have to reach out here to this huge circle yet. There's a way to get there. Yeah,
I love that. I love that. And that's what helped me a lot too. For me, I separated my year into 4 quarters and it's like taking on things one at a time, because all of these podcasts about different areas, it can be overwhelming if you're trying to do all these things at once.
Yeah.
So I love the simplicity of the polyvagal theory, that, and you can start so simple.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I mean, you've given us so much incredible information today, Deb. I'm wondering if you had any just final words for someone out there who's bedbound or housebound and like really struggling, anything you would say to them about starting with polyvagal theory and about their situation.
Yeah, so I do want to say that I have this belief that our nervous system longs to come to regulation, that that's built in, that longing is built in, and inherently knows how to get there. So I really believe that whether it's, you know, a physical illness or a psychological suffering we're in, that if we listen and open those pathways, the nervous system will begin to take us back to well-being. So I truly believe that, and I want people to join me in that. Well, one thing that I think people find helpful is, you know, on my website, we have audio meditations, and they're free to listen to. But my creative director composed music to go along with my reading the meditations. And there's something lovely about voice and music together in that rhythm that can be an invitation, but not a demand to do anything. You can just receive.
Yeah. Right?
And again, as I say, invitation and demand, your nervous system needs to feel invited.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as it feels like it's being asked to do something, a demand placed on it, it's going to retreat, right? But an invitation. So I think something easy to reach for, push a button and hear some music, or, you know, really hold the hope, hold that knowing that your nervous system does know how to get you there. It's just going to you got to partner with it, and it will eventually take you back, as yours has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's such beautiful wisdom. Thank you so much, Deb, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Every episode that you tune into, my hope is always that you feel inspired in some way, or that you learn something new and insightful or practical that you can begin implementing in your healing experience. Now that you are done listening, go out and do something fun today. And until next time, make this whole week great.
Well, I found my light. The fruit became the doorway, and now it's open wide. The dark within my dark is where I found my light. The fruit became the doorway, and now it's open wide. The fruit for darkness.